We were American citizens of Japanese ancestry, ordered by the President of the United States to be imprisoned in the United States, in our case, Arkansas, and guarded over by the U.S. military. They were American concentration camps for Americans of Japanese ancestry.
So they called them relocation centers. They were America's versions of concentration camps. Anyway,
all that she could remember is just blood everywhere in the mess hall. That's all she could remember. He and his family were put in a horse stall. They were given
put in a horse stall.
Yeah, they were given burlap bags, told to just to stuff it with the hay, whatever was in there.
Many have compared what happened to all these different groups happening now with the Muslims. Now, Muslims are perceived as the other,
right.
But a Muslim can be Irish, Japanese, like we can see right
That's
here.
Right. The danger.
Assalamu alaikum, greetings of peace. Welcome to the Dean Shaw Media, your host, and we got a lot to talk about today with my next guest, Brian Ozaki. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, I'm doing well, thank you.
Very nice to have you here with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, we're going to be talking about the camps that were set up here in the United States, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. All this is set up now. I mean, all this is part of some of the work you do to create awareness of a history that's actually been forgotten.
Yes, about the Japanese-American internment camps that happened back in 1940 during, or the 1940s during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Now, your parents were in those camps?
Yes. Both my parents, my dad's side was, they're from Seattle. So they went to a different camp. They were ended up in Minidoka in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And my mom is from California. She bounced around for three camps, and she was separated. Her and her mom were separated from their father. He is, in a Japanese term, they call him Kibei. So they're born in the United States. They are educated in Japan and then brought back to the United States. And because he was able to read and write, he was separated as soon as Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan. And he was sent to a Department of Justice camp in Santa Fe. And my mom and her mother were sent to three different camps all the while being separated.
So they call it internment camps.
But it's not really an internment.
What does that mean? What are they trying to say about internment camps?
You know, it wasn't really for their protection,
yeah.
The Japanese Americans. Two-thirds of the Japanese Americans, 120,000, they're American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They were incarcerated.
The numbers I heard were probably even more. This is a lower number. Lower
it's possible
number.
Because there were numbers from Alaska. People from Peru were brought over. People were put in Department of Justice camps and not only the War Relocation Authority camps. So the numbers could have been larger. And only the people that were on the Western seaboard were truly affected by it.
Mm-hmm. But so paint the picture to us. What got us thinking that this is far away from reality is something that not too long ago people were actually talking about putting Muslims in these camps.
That's right.
Right?
Absolutely. And the Japanese Americans people who were in the camps that were incarcerated generations past, they stood up right away. As soon as they heard about this Muslim ban, 1.0, they jumped out and they were on the front lines talking about, we've been here before, we know where this is going. So they were out there, they were picketing, they were showing their solidarity with the Muslim people.
Who, the Japanese?
Yes, the Japanese Americans.
They're like, we've heard this story before.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now paint the picture. I mean, okay, these are, now many people don't understand that these were American citizens.
Yes, they were, right. Two-thirds were American citizens. They were born here, and that just didn't really matter. The writing on the wall was that it was for the Japanese American, their protection. However, any of the camps that if anybody visited or had pictures of, there were guard towers, and there was barbed wire, and there were gun turrets on the top, but they were facing inside towards the camp, not outside, away from the camp. So they weren't protecting anybody from coming into the camp. They were trying to make sure nobody from inside the camp was going to get out.
Now, was there a justifiable means to this? Was there something going on that there was some evidence proof that now citizens were going to rebel against their government?
There wasn't actual proof. What happened was there was a lot of wartime hysteria. There was a lot of fear. There was already an anti-Asian sentiment happening way before 1941, and this was just an excuse. There was the Chinese Exclusion Act that was going on, and they needed cheap labor to come in to help farm on the West Coast, so they brought Japanese in to farm. They were able to farm land that was thought to be just, you couldn't grow anything on it, and they were able to do it. So then what happened was this kind of helped the Farmers Association to, let's get behind this. We'll push the Japanese Americans out. We can take their property and their fields and their growth.
That's what actually happens when they got put in these camps. All their businesses, properties, everything, the locals, whoever, people ended up taking that.
Yes, you were only allowed to bring what you could carry, and that was it. People were selling their property, their farming equipment, their businesses for nothing.
A lot of it just got, they didn't end up getting that back, right?
No.
So it was stolen.
Yes.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Just to put it bluntly.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, so this lasted 3 years. But before that, it was for some time that there was the sentiment that there was this fear mongering going on, kind of like what we see today.
Exactly. It's exactly what's happening. And you can see the similarities. And there are some people out there that will say, this is completely different than what happened to the Japanese Americans. What happened with the Japanese Americans, they were U.S. citizens, people that these bands like the Muslim ban or the people seeking refuge and asylum, they're saying they're not U.S. citizens. The problem is that we're treating people inhumanely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real focus of it. And what you did to a group of people that didn't look like the rest of the world or the rest of the country, that's what's happening now. And people really don't know Muslims. People really don't know the people who are trying to seek asylum, no matter where they're from. So there's a fear out there. But they're treating them so inhumanely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have Muhammad Ali. He's a citizen. The guy who built the Muslims who built the Sears Towers, they're citizens, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing here. You have so many Muslim Americans who were born here, who now people start to look at like suspiciously, with the media giving half-truths and the politicians, right, a lot of times pushing a lot of this division, hate.
Absolutely. Just like, I don't know if you're aware, Asia Bandawi, she's from Bridgeview. She made a documentary. Bridgeview was under surveillance for many years before 9/11. The government couldn't find anything, so they stopped surveillance. Then 9/11 happened, and then they started to surveil again. But nothing came out of it. They couldn't find anybody that was doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. So now, going back to the internment camps or the camps, pretty much just like jails that were set up, that were housing over 100, that incarcerated over 120,000 plus of American citizens, pretty much the Japanese. And then after 3 years, then they were released?
They were released. You could have gotten out earlier if you had a sponsor, somebody on the interior of the United States that could sponsor you for a job. The places that the 10 camps that were created, they were not there. So they were built as they were being relocated. So first people were put in places like state fairs, open fields, horse farms, like my dad went to pile up in on the West Coast. And what happened was he and his family were put in a horse stall. They were given
your father.
Yeah,
was put in a horse stall.
Yeah, they were given burlap bags, told to just to stuff it with the hay, whatever was in there, and they stayed there for a while until Minidoka was ready.
What was your father doing before this happened? What was he involved in? What kind of a business? What was he?
He was in school, but his family, they took care of like a rooming house in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did they feel that they felt this was coming on? Was this something that just overnight people came and came and took them? And
for my dad's side of the family, that's how it felt to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now then what happens is from there, and this is without any trial, without any,
right. A notice went up, executive order 9066 went up, told them to be at a specific designated area and to be there with what you can carry in your hands. And that was it. From there, they were taken by buses with shades drawn, so you couldn't see out and people couldn't see in. They got dropped off at, for my parents, like for my dad, they got dropped off at the racetrack. And then from there, when they went to Minidoka, they got onto trains and took the train to Minidoka. It is a desolate area in Idaho. It's by Twin Falls, Idaho. There is nothing but dust in the summer. It's hot in the winter. It's snow. There are makeshift barracks with just tar paper on the outside. So dust came in, snow came in. It was cold, and you had multiple families living in one barracks.
So you just got a notice saying, show up here. What did it read like? All Japanese citizens?
Yeah. So that's what it read, and then you showed
literally,
up.
Literally, it said all Japanese
yeah.
need to report here and here, or you're going to be, shot, killed? What I mean, some kind of consequence?
Because what happened was they made it seem as though it was for their protection.
Yeah.
But everybody was stripped of their identity. So you were not given your name. You didn't get to keep your name. You were given a tag with a number.
You become a number.
Yes. So yeah? You had a tag with a number. You put that on each person in your family.
Do you remember what number your father was?
I don't.
So they got a number. Yeah. That's how they're identified. Yeah. Not by their name anymore, by that number. Wow.
No.
And that's not too, that was around the corner.
It was really, it was 78 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then pretty much your whole livelihood, everything that you worked up until about that time, it was all gone then, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And then when camps let out, like my mom and her mom, they had nowhere to go. So they stayed in camps until it closed in 46. And then when you got let out, you were given $25 and a train ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
Reagan, sometime later, he paid out some.
Yeah, he did. There was some money that was paid out, like $20,000 to each person that was still living, that was incarcerated.
Uh-huh.
Correct.
What did you think about that?
You know, I was a kid, so you know.
Your parents? How did they?
Right. I mean, to my dad, it was a slap in the face.
Mm-hmm.
My dad took this to heart, and my dad was a certain way his entire life. He was, he couldn't be more pro-American than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up fighting for the United States during the Korean War. He only bought American cars. If anybody disrespected the flag, he was going to tell you right away. I mean, he loved America, and there was things that he did that it wasn't until later on that I figured out why he did it. You know, like he didn't want to be known as Japanese or Asian or somebody different. He wanted to be that American guy. But, you know, you can't erase the color of your skin. You mm-hmm. can't erase the way that your features look, you know. But, you know, that's what happened to him. That's how he lived out his life based off of what happened to him.
Mm-hmm. So then you have the releasing of the Japanese from the camps around 19...
About 45, 46.
That's when Hiroshima and Nagasaki happened, right?
Well, Hiroshima, yeah. So it was right after that where Japan kind of like they lost the war, and then they just... That was it. And they were releasing people before that if they had sponsors, but it was after that they just kind of said, okay, we're releasing.
Yeah. How many people died in that? Innocent people. I mean, innocent lives.
A ton of innocent people died. I don't have that number. but a ton of people died.
To this day, you have people who are still suffering.
Absolutely. I went and saw, and this was many years ago, probably over 10 years ago, I went to go see a woman who wrote this book called Atomic Mom. And she was one of the women who helped develop the atomic bomb. And then she worked with some Japanese women, and they were probably second or third generation, and she was still having issues, health issues from the atomic bomb.
Yeah, it's in the hundreds of thousands minimum. These are probably low numbers. I mean, and then millions who have been affected still, where there's this indiscriminate just bomb on
humanity. And you know, we're the only country to ever use this bomb. And now, you know, we're the ones that are telling people not to use it, right? But we have the most of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So we talk about these things now to... And why do you now? Why do you're part of an organization that comes out and speaks and creates awareness? What motivated you to do that, to be a part of something like this?
You know, it had to have been my family and my dad. You know, the second and third generations, they didn't really speak about this stuff at all. They didn't speak about the camps. I had to really do my research and then pull it out of my parents. They didn't want to talk about it.
They were still traumatized probably, right?
Yeah, it was definitely. Just a part of history that, you know, they didn't want to talk about it. They lived it, they experienced it, but they didn't want to talk about it. So I kept pulling it out of them. And, you know, it was something that I remembered that I didn't learn about too much. I just heard about a little bit and that was it. So, you know, when my son was in the fifth grade, his teacher, she's brilliant, and she was going over this chapter in history, and she happened to find out from my son that his grandparents, my parents, were in these camps. So she really sent my wife and I a letter asking, please, can they come in? So my parents said no, but I eventually got them to say yes. And they came into the school and they taught and they shared their experience with the class in a very G-rated version for the fifth graders. And they recorded it. And ever since then, I mean, this was 7 years ago, 8 years ago. And every year since then, she shows this video to the kids and the kids send my parents thank you cards. And just how they can relate, what they remembered from the stories. And I mean, that's incredible. That's a way to get this awareness out. And with JACL, which is an organization that I sit on the board with, they have a program where they go out to schools and to organizations and they teach this history. And that is a new program that started a couple of years ago. And it's something that it needs to be taught so people just don't forget what had happened to innocent people, you know, back in the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Are there any unique stories that stand out? I'm sure you've heard a lot from people who are, such as your family or others, who have been into these camps at that time that you recall that had a profound impact that you can share with us?
Yeah, you know, it's the Japanese community, the Japanese-American community, you know, at one point in my life, I thought, where are they? And then I found out they're around, they just dispersed a lot more. My dad used to tell me about a kid that he knew when he was in camp that drowned in this river while they were at camp. Well, a few years ago in 2017, I was talking to this lady and I was interviewing her for a project. That boy, she knew that boy. That boy actually saved her sister's life. Her sister had a blood disease and she needed a transfusion, and this boy had the exact blood match. He saved her life and then he went on passing away in the river. I mean, the odds of the relationship of my dad to this boy and to this boy to this woman and her sister, I mean, they're from opposite ends of this country. I mean, it's amazing. You know, there are a lot of stories out there of people witnessing one person witnessed a chef. Oh, this is the same lady. She witnessed the chef that got shot by the military police. And all that she could remember is just blood everywhere in the mess hall. That's all she could remember. And
why,
he passed away.
Why did he shoot him?
Nobody knows. She doesn't know. She just knows that he got shot.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't remember.
So how much if you look back of the people, because you have really good hearted Americans here who wouldn't stand for that, you know, how many were fighting against that, as opposed to the other, you know, the people of prejudice, people who exercise racism, people who had that hate in their hearts, who were pushing this. There must have been some kind of divide there. What was there? How was it like?
You know,
when you looked into this.
Yeah, back in the 40s, because there was an anti-Asian sentiment happening.
Yeah,
and I think also I think there were several different things that were happening at that time. One, that being it. Also, the Japanese tend to be, they kind of keep to themselves and they don't create waves.
Yeah.
Right. So, also at that time, of all the documents, of all the pictures, of any of the home videos, nobody stood up for the Japanese Americans.
There was no one protesting.
No one protesting. There were some that like were friends because they knew that, like from the community. So some people saved some of the property. Some people saved some belongings. But it wasn't like today where you see, you know, groups of thousands of people out there protesting against, you know, anti-immigration or the Muslim ban or women's rights. You didn't see that back then.
No. How about the exercising of one of the statements attributed to Jesus, love your neighbor, all the verses that talk about peace and love? Did you have these Christians coming up? And there had to have been some coming up. You didn't hear much about that?
I haven't read or seen anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's possible it could exist, but yeah. Of all the documentations that I've read and the videos and the pictures that I've seen, I just didn't
see. These are times when God is testing humanity. You see, it's human beings. A lot of times we want to blame the Creator, God Almighty. We say Allah, and then these wars happen. But it's the human beings that start these wars. The human beings that cause this corruption on Earth, and then God Almighty, Allah, He gives us these opportunities for people to step up and show their mercy, to come up and show that love. And then now this is going to be a witness against a lot of people on the Day of Judgment. Right.
See,
because it's easy to profess faith, I believe in God and all that, but what are you doing when you see injustice like this happening?
Yeah, and I think everybody has their level of how they perceive that or take that, right? Mm-hmm. For me, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave us free will, right? And it's up to us to do what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to do, right? I just think that, I guess it depends on what's more important at that time, maybe.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you. I can only tell you how I feel about that.
Yeah. So some of our viewers just probably got surprised. They heard you say the term Allah, which simply means the Creator, God Almighty, and they're wondering. So you had some exposure to Islam, and then you actually yourself accepted Islam and became a Muslim?
I did.
And for those that don't know, Islam simply means to submit your will to the Creator, and a Muslim was one who does that action of submitting to the will of the one God.
That's right.
So you were saying?
Yeah, so I did. I grew up very different, and, you know, I grew up in a Buddhist home,
mm-hmm.
and didn't work for me. And I think Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala every single day, multiple times a day, for being here, for telling me, teaching me, guiding me, what I need to do to prepare myself for Jannah, right? Mm-hmm. So it's hard to describe. For me, it's like it's a feeling that brings a smile to my face.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives me purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this whatever I can do to help humanity to my ability. I mean, I'm not anybody, but whatever I can do, say something to somebody, spread awareness, you know, it's...
And that's one of the means to fulfilling the purpose of life is to be, when you're in the service, when you're worshiping, serving your creator, you're serving mankind. You're trying to be a good asset, a good ambassador. You're trying to be a good humanitarian. You're trying to spread goodness. And this is one of those things. This is one of those ways. But you've obviously had to really engross yourself in studying the text, the Quran, the Sunnah, because you would not have come, I'm assuming for sure, someone who parents were oppressed, they've seen oppression, and now you have the media making Islam look like it's a terrorist religion, making it look like it's an oppressive way of life for women. You wouldn't, I mean, going, why would you go in that direction if you didn't learn the opposite?
You know, it's, I think it's because I've been around Muslims for more than half my life. And, you know, I've always stood up for Islam because, you know, a lot of people don't have that knowledge. And when somebody doesn't have even the most basic knowledge, they become fearful. And when they become fearful, they become, I don't know, angry or belligerent.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would, to the best of my knowledge at that point in time, I would try to, you know, tell them that whatever you're hearing, it's just, it's not what it is, right? And you try to give them examples, and people would pull things from here and there and say, well, this says this. And, you know, you got to tell them, well, you're giving them just this small portion. You can't base your judgments on just this one portion. You know, you have to have the entire text before and after it to get an entire picture.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it's not even that simple. You have to have the whole parts even before that and after that to truly understand that. And then you have to have the stories that backfill that, right? Like the hadiths, right? You need some of that information to give it more context.
Yeah.
So it's not as cut and dry and saying, oh, they're barbarians and they treat their women terribly and they're not allowed to do this and they can have, you know, X amount of wives. It's just, you know, you can't get angry with people like that. You just have to try to tell them that, you know, that's not what it is and this is what it is,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Now, we saw that hate being perpetuated with many people who have come over to the Americas, starting with, let's say you had the Catholics, so you had Christian on Christian hate, so you had the Christians hating on the Catholics from here, and then you had the Irish, then you had, what came after that? Then now you start coming along, you had the Japanese now. Now we have a live example of your parents who are in those jails, those camps. So we can see like when anyone who was perceived as the other.
Right.
Right, who doesn't walk like us, talk like us, have the slang like us, doesn't have skin like color like us?
Right,
they're the other. But it even went so far back as to other. Just they had the skin, same color, but maybe a different little dialect.
Sure.
But now it's coming. So we have a live example we were giving with your story, your family story, of something that didn't just happen yesterday.
It was like 78 years ago.
Yeah, it was just around the corner.
Yeah,
and now history is there so we can study it, so hopefully we can get some good from it, not let the evils repeat itself. But now many have compared what happened to all these different groups happening now with the Muslims. Now Muslims are perceived as the other,
right?
But a Muslim can be Irish, Japanese, like we can see right.
That's
here,
right.
Mexican, Italian, white American, because a Muslim is one like Jesus, Moses, Abraham, Muhammad, peace be upon them all, one who just submits to the will of God.
That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I think that's what the power, you know, a lot of the satanic forces and the people of division, the people who want to spread this hate, that's what they fear Islam a lot, because Islam brings humanity together. You know, Islam is something that unites people under the worship of one God, doing good deeds, being a good human being. And I had an interview with a Christian not too long ago, Mr. Benjamin, and his followers, they were watching the program, and they got to see us interact and talk. And then we heard some of their feedback, and I was amazed to see like what some people were saying. One particularly stuck out. He said, "I cannot believe how stupid I was," something like that, saying that, "I don't believe anything the media says, majority of it, but why now?" He had to come to terms with his own self and say, "Why now when it comes to Muslims do I believe what the media says? But another thing, I question everything. But now when it comes to Muslims, when they say something against Muslims and Islam, I just swallow it whole."
Right.
You know?
Oftentimes, you know, if you don't know any Muslims, right, you don't know, right? You have no idea. And then you have to think, you know, what does a Muslim look like? You know, I hear oftentimes about how people are like, "Well, you know, you don't look like a Muslim," or, you know, "How do I know if you're Muslim or not?" Right? You know, it's not something you wear unless, you know, if you wear a hijab or, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, what does a Muslim look like? You know, it looks like you. Looks
you?
Like me. I mean.
Yeah.
You know.
We're totally now opposite probably to what people will be thinking the Muslims look like, right? Because they're thinking some Arab in the desert, big turban with a sword on a camel.
Sure, absolutely. You know, it's like whatever they want to show in the movies, right? In entertainment.
Uh-huh. But they got two right now sitting in front of them on the screen, big screen, huh? Yeah. So we crushed that stereotype right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Another thing is, when you think about the justice and the beauty of this beautiful way of life, Islam, that would never allow something like, when you look at this indiscriminate bombing of innocent human beings like the Hiroshima Nagasaki. I mean, Muslims didn't do this. I mean, this is something that Islam is totally, there is no exception to killing innocent human beings, just
killing
indiscriminately.
Killing one person is like killing all of mankind.
That's right? A verse from the Quran.
Yeah. You got to take that to heart. I mean, you have to believe it.
Yeah. So it's crazy how, you know, you see some people doing the worst heinous criminal acts and then flipping it and trying to make Muslims, you know, as they're the people terrorizing and spreading corruption in the earth. It's amazing. It reminds me of a verse in the Quran where God Almighty is talking about this, talking about they wish to spread, I'm paraphrasing, saying that they're the people of peace, but they're actually the ones spreading corruption in the land. It's crazy.
It is. Yeah. It's unfortunate. And I think, you know, part of what people on the outside would see is they're seeing culture as opposed to seeing the religion.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's not entirely their fault for seeing that too.
Yeah.
Right. So I think in some cases, you know, we have to take responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I, you know, I believe in the pure faith, and so, you know, I try to my best every day to do the best that I can based on Islam.
What was it that finally had you? How much time did it take for you researching that you finally decided that this is the way of life from the Creator, and I'm going to accept it?
You know, I was tired of just the way that I was living my life. You know, nobody was holding me accountable for it, right? And I kept screwing up. You know, and when you screw up, oftentimes, you know, it hurts you. But a lot of times, it hurts others too when you screw up. So, you know, I was tired of screwing up. And I wasn't, the way I was living my life wasn't working. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala showed me, you know, I mean, He holds me accountable for all of my actions. And, you know, it's been a blessing.
Mm-hmm. You've traveled to Japan?
When I was a kid, before Islam, but I'm traveling to Japan, inshallah. I'm traveling to Japan in a few months.
How is Islam being received over there? I heard there's a growing Muslim community in Japan.
It's growing. And, you know, it's funny you bring that up. Last night, I happened to turn on this Japanese show. It's a It's called NHK. So yeah. It's a station, Japanese station in Japan, and they were talking about Islam. It was the craziest thing. My wife and I we couldn't believe it, and how it.
They like
were
a mainstream about, channel.
It's a Japanese station that shows nothing but things happening in Japan. It's like watching CNN, but yeah. just it's all from Japan. And they were talking about this Pakistani guy that's been living there for 20 years, and he immersed himself in the culture, and he's Muslim, and I think they're in an area where it's got the largest mosque. So they have, I think he said there's like 600 Muslims that pray here. But in their newsfeed, they were mostly like Pakistani. I didn't see any Japanese. However, I have seen a couple of mosques in Tokyo. And I did read a story about some Japanese people in Islam. And I read articles about how they're being more accommodating towards people in Islam. They dedicate prayer rooms in public spaces. They're making halal and zabiha food more accessible for people. There's a big Malaysian a group that goes there. I mean, it's, you know, they come, they do business, they vacation. So, you know, Malaysia is a huge Muslim population. Mm-hmm. So they are more accommodating towards Muslim people now.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful to hear.
Yeah. Do you speak I'm no, I don't. Mm-hmm. I kick myself for that. And I'm sure my mom does too. Mm-hmm. Cause my mom can speak, but I'm really excited to go because I really want to see like this Muslim culture out there.
Yeah. Now the Japanese, some of the Japanese cultural things that we know about, tell me, is this true? Is like before you go into a Japanese house, you can't take your shoes. You have to take your shoes off.
Yes.
Right. That's part of Japanese culture.
Yeah. They're very big into cleanliness. Okay. So before you enter the house, you take your shoes off. And so you would wear slippers, and then they would have special slippers for like the restroom.
Yeah.
So you only have restroom slippers, and then you have the rest of the house slippers.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's beautiful because Islam, you know, cleanliness, you know, purity is a part of our iman, our faith.
Yes.
So we do the same thing, take your shoes off in the house, right?
Right.
You're always making sure you're clean, right?
Absolutely.
Spiritually, physically.
Absolutely.
So now when somebody from the Japanese, they accept, this is one of those things of the culture that just goes really, because with Islam, you don't just throw everything out the culture. There's some things like, for instance, in some cultures, mainly here, there's a lot of good things, but there's some things like it's just common to go in the house with the shoes.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, so you're bringing in, like, I did a program on this talking about this, you know, but this is something that people can adapt, take from one of the beautiful things, Islam and the Japanese culture, right? Because they did a study about the hundreds of different germs and things that you yeah. bring in and your shoes and you bring inside the house and
put it on your bed. Yeah, you jump yeah. on the bed with your shoes on. Yeah.
And that's the thing about now. You think now you have, because your way is superior, but then you end up putting other people down because you don't understand that. Why I got to take my shoes off, this and that and the other. And then you're right. seeing like, wow, this actually makes more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else is there? With Japanese, they'll do the Japanese will, the tradition was more, less handshake, more of a nod.
It was a bow. Correct.
Yeah.
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's always kind of like, you know, there's different angles of bows.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, there's different angles of bows, right? Mm-hmm. And so depending on, you know, it's also a level of respect,
yeah.
right? Whether it's a teacher or a parent or an elder, right? You would always try to at least have your bow lower than theirs.
Yeah.
Right? And you wouldn't raise from your bow until they would raise first, right? Mm-hmm. It's a lot of it just is based off of respect.
Yeah.
You know, you do martial arts, yeah. Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I do kendo, so there's a lot of similarities between the culture and Islam. That I sometimes parallel.
Yeah.
because it's important and it's amazing on these parallels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think respect is a huge part of that.
See, now you can I mean, that's the part about getting educated, traveling, understanding other people's cultures. Because again, this is another area where people start to put down Islam, put down Muslims. I make this parallel with the Japanese culture. And now let's say, for instance, someone, it's about great respect. Let's say someone who's a Muslim, he shows great respect towards the opposite gender, a woman, right? He'll hug his mom, his aunt, and he'll hug her and squeeze his daughter. But now someone else's wife, he's not groping all, he's not kissing her and no. Almost on a, like on the cheek, but almost on the lips and stuff. And, yeah. You know, hugging her. And no, it's like respect. He respects your wife. He's not going to even touch her. He doesn't come in her space.
That's right.
Right. It's not about putting a woman down.
That's right.
Right. So I make this parallel. Well, now you can, because just because you don't understand, it's a little different than your culture. Why are you going to go crazy and start, you know, spewing all sorts of hate rhetoric and whatnot because you just don't understand?
Yeah, I believe that's, you know, it's not for everybody, and everybody doesn't do that, and I believe that it is. Yeah,
hate, I'm specifically, you know,
fear is you're not born with it.
No,
it's something you're taught, whether it's in the home or within your peers, and it's just the lack of that education of knowing what you fear and what you hate.
You know what I'm talking about, right? You have those specific group of people, but it's sad because sometimes if the good people, they remain silent, they don't speak out, then it spreads like a disease.
It does. And then, but you know, hopefully, you know, within time you can maybe turn that disease around. And
hope
for a cure.
Yeah, it's very important. That's why talking about these things and discussing it and helping people to understand, because sometimes you're just brought up in your little town, your little village, your little area, and all you get to see is people with the same color as you, look like you, and then anything else. You don't travel much. And now any opportunity that something doesn't look the same way you do it, then it's the other. And then you develop that fear, and then you attack what you fear.
Yes. Yeah.
So just going back to what we started with, that's why one of the things, is that one of the reasons now creating this awareness of these internment, these camps that were created for 3, almost 4 years with the Japanese Americans, a good portion of them citizens, that now if we don't remember this history, that it can repeat itself again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you just strip it back and you just talk about the humanity of it, right? I mean, it's happening now with asylum seekers seeking a better life, not only for themselves, for their families, right? And you have to kind of, you know, in Islam, you should have this empathy. And you have to really think about why are people wanting to come here? Why are people wanting to flee wherever their home is, right? Whatever their home is, wherever their home is, it must be wanting a better life. Right. And then to be treated at the gate and just treated just so inhumanely, you know, not giving them the opportunity to come into this country. The percentage of asylum seekers that actually come in is like 0.04%, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
0.04%. The camp that we were just at had about 1,800 people in it in Matamoros, 1,800 people. So 0.04% of that population will come into the United States. That's almost nothing. And to see how they're forced to live just to, so they can have a better life, no matter what they're fleeing, whether it's violence, drugs, war, anything that they're fleeing, to live in how they're living, to them it's so worth it to live in these conditions, to flee from where they're fleeing. You have to think about, if they're here living like this, imagine what they're running from. And we have to, as humans, think harder about this and try to help them.
Where were, so you went down, this was in Texas?
It's right on the border of Brownsville, Brownsville, Texas, just on the opposite end of the Rio Grande is Matamoros, Mexico, and that's where there's a tent camp right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are the asylum seekers who are trying to come in.
Yes.
So what you've been there? How is it down? What's the status of the people now? And what happens when they enter these? They're in a camp there, right?
They're in a camp. They're in a tent camp, and they're on the levee side of the Rio Grande.
Uh-huh.
So if the Rio Grande ever floods, I mean, they're going to hit it. I mean, they're in direct path of it.
Yeah.
You know, they're segregated by kind of like by the country where they're from. And so they have these neighborhoods, and they make do with what they have, with what God created. You know, they're making kitchens out of what God created by tree branches, twine, mud, earth, and then whatever they can find to use as a cooking element, mm-hmm. like a part of a file cabinet they'll use as a stovetop. I mean, the ingenuity that they have to survive is amazing. But, you know, when we were, they don't have jobs. They want jobs. They want a life. They want to provide for their family. But we just aren't giving them this opportunity. They're given opportunities to go to court, but the court is against them. There's such a language barrier that they don't have the information that they need in order to help them pass through into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are sent back to either their country or another country, and majority of them are facing death when they get there. And, you know, when you feed them, there's an organization called World Central Kitchen. And they're a new organization by Chef Andres. And he creates this group, this World Central Kitchen, and they go to these post-emergency devastated areas like camps, like in Japan, the cruise ship that's holding all the people aboard the ship because of the coronavirus in the Bahamas, and they provide food. They provide food for people that need it, and it's such an amazing company. We went down there, we prepared food for like over 1,200 people, and it was so amazing. All the volunteers were so lovely and smiling, and they worked 18-hour days, 7 days a week, preparing food, handing it out to people. These people are their friends, you know. These people are also volunteers, and it's, you know, that's like the ummah.
Mm-hmm.
when you watch this, and
yeah,
you're down there and you look at this, and it makes you just think like, there's got to be more that you can do.
Mm-hmm. That's what Islam is about, huh? Helping humanity. It doesn't matter what color of your skin, what race, nationality.
Where you come from, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. It doesn't matter what your economic status is. It doesn't matter whether you're born on this side or this side of the tracks. I mean, we're the same. We're, you know, their blood's the same color as mine. You mm-hmm. know, they breathe the same air as I do, you know. That's what it's about.
How do your parents feel about you going and creating awareness now about the history of what the semi almost forgotten history, going down to Texas, visiting the asylum seekers there who are trying to get in, safe passage. What did they say when they hear about this? Are they scared for you? Are they so happy? Are they?
My mom is scared.
Yeah,
she, you know, she always worries about my safety, whether it's, you know, coming to Islam, she was worried for my safety. You know, whether traveling to create awareness, she's worried about my safety. She's always going to be my mom. She's always going to be my parent. She's always going to be scared for me. But, you know, at the same time, she's also very happy and proud of who I became, you know, so.
It's quite a different picture when you have the more of the acceptance and the hospitality, the accommodations that are made in Japan. Now, when you compare that to China, have you been to China?
I have not.
What's your opinion there? When you see like the Uyghur Muslims, you have like how many now are in the camp? Almost 3 million, is it?
Yeah, it's a shame. I can't even pretend to understand it.
Yeah,
because you know I'm not there. I'm not part of the culture and that society. So, you know, for me to give just like such a, I don't know, I don't think I can give that kind of an opinion. I can just see from the outside what it looks like. Something has to be done.
Yeah.
I mean, to have citizens of a country wrangled up and put in an area that they can never leave, and you know they're being told they can't practice their religion, they can't, you know, wear hijab, they can't do the things that, you know, they grew up doing or recently came to do, you know, I mean, it's not
How are Muslims received, like the Muslim women who are imitating Mary, the mother of Jesus, wearing the hijab, who are practicing that modest dress code in Japan? How do they get received over there, from your knowledge?
I honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, like historically,
yeah,
Japanese clothing has been modest.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you go back to what they looked like wearing kimonos. None of it was skin tight.
Yeah, that's another part of the, yeah.
None of it was, you know.
What do you call it again?
A kimono.
Kimono, yeah. Kimono, that's what we use in the martial arts also.
It's close, you know. And so that's why like in kendo, you know, it's one of the oldest martial ways of Japanese culture of fighting, right? It's way of the sword, how it's loosely translated. But, you know, I try to bring that into the Muslim community, because unlike a lot of other sports, especially for the young Muslim sisters, you know, they have to come up with ways to adapt to play the sports, right? In a modest way, right? Like in gymnastics or swimming or whatnot. But in kendo, you know, you wear hakama, which is the lower half, which is extremely comfortable. They're just really wide pants. And then you have your gi, which is very loose fitting. And then you wear your bogu, your armor, on top of all of that. And, mm-hmm. you know, especially for a young sister who wears, or an older sister, doesn't matter, wearing hijab, you know, you're covered. You know, so you don't have to worry about what do I have to figure out to be a part of this, right? I mean, obviously it's not only for people or for women who wear hijab, but, you know, it's something where you don't have to worry about trying to find an alternate clothing apparel to fit this.
Yeah.
Right.
So when you hear about we just mentioned a part of the culture of modesty, the greeting of respect, then we talked about the cleanliness. And now when you add in some of the other things, if you're talking to someone of Japanese background, do you feel like, because we know Islam is the natural way, you know, worship the creator, not the creation, be a good human being, be morally upright. It just, the tenets of Islam just makes sense. It's not hard to comprehend, to live. It's the pure way. So when you talk to someone who already in their culture has many of these qualities, have you had experience in talking to some Japanese people? Have they been receptive? Have you shared some of the teachings of Islam? How do they take to it?
I mean, honestly, it's not a subject that gets brought up. I think because I think there is this respect level even between generations of being Japanese American or people from Japan. I just think that there's this respect level, and I'm sure people have these discussions, but personally with me, they don't ask me, and they don't talk about it. I'm always open to talk about it, but it's just not something that really happens. Yeah. And you know what, to be perfectly honest, I can't grow facial hair, right? It's like a, for me, it's a Japanese gene. I just can't grow facial hair, right? So, and I don't wear a dopey. So it's like, you know, if you were to look at me, you would walk right by me and not even think about saying salam to me, yeah. Right? So I'm sure it's the same. When other people see me from my culture, they probably just think of me as just Japanese and that's it. They don't think of me as being Muslim.
Mm-hmm. When you said you're going soon to Japan?
Yeah, in a few months.
What's the main martial art there that's practiced?
Well, I think
that originates from there.
Well, sumo is a huge Japanese sport that is there. Kendo.
We'd have to adjust the attire for sumo.
There's a lot of touching and grabbing in there.
Yeah.
But for like kendo's, it's taught all the way from like grade school.
What's taught?
Kendo.
Uh-huh.
Kendo is the way of the sword. So,
yeah.
You know, when samurais could no longer practice being a samurai, they would hide it by doing kendo. And it's instead of the sword, it's a bamboo sword. And so I would say that's maybe one of the majority of the martial ways that is being taught.
Is the fighting with the sword?
Yes.
Yeah. They have some of the best, what is it? What's the name of the sword? The specific sword that the samurais would use out there? There's a specific name for it. I forgot. Is it tatami sword or?
Oh, the katana sword?
Katana sword, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just even the craftsmanship of building the sword is amazing. If you ever watch a documentary,
so summarize. This is the way the when you study. This is from the Japanese.
Yeah, it's right? The way of the samurai. The way of the sword. Correct.
And then they had certain principles that they would live by.
Yeah, it's the Budo. It's the way of Budo. It's the way of the warrior. It's how there are seven principles. There are several principles.
Do you remember some of those? You had integrity. You had courage. You had what else? Character. You had really. I mean, when you look at all the points, some really good points that correlate really beautifully with Islam.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I agree with you 100%.
Like if many people would just live by some of those principles, they probably wouldn't have been the internment camps, right?
Probably not.
Yeah. If people were living by some of those principles, we wouldn't have much of the conflicts. But that's the thing. A lot of times we go away from many of these good principles that were ultimately sent down by the Creator for humanity. And then we end up, following the ways that
it's easier to do the wrong thing than to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So at the end, before we conclude, what message would you have for, now with the past, and then what can we learn from that for people who didn't know this history, who are learning about it now, listening to us, seeing a Japanese Muslim for the first time, right? Someone who has heard so many negative things out there. What would you say? What would you say to such a person? What?
You know, I would ask them to ask me questions,
mm-hmm.
or if you know a Muslim, talk to them. If you don't know a Muslim, befriend a Muslim. Right? You know, I think it's the only way that you would understand. And if you know, you want to talk about immigration policies or Muslim bans, you know, you have to talk to people to understand. Talk to people firsthand, right? People who know about the subject, somebody who has experienced the subject in one form or fashion. You know, it's all about the education. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it comes down to, is just to be educated.
Wow, that's profound, to be educated. I mean, when we're not educated properly, ignorance leads.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier to, like I said, you know, when ignorance leads you, it's just easier to do the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you see with now the political race coming now, with the new elections, Do you see some of this stuff being brought back to the surface again?
I do, and I think the only way to combat it truly is to get out and vote. I think that's the only way that is a way to possibly stop it or to slow it down, is to get out and vote. And hopefully, you know, whatever your vote is, you know, make sure it's the right vote, you know, whatever you believe in. But I think, you know, bring about awareness, you know, speak publicly about it, speak up about it, you know, have conviction, and, you know, just educate.
Mm-hmm. Do you get in, because you've done, just a couple more questions, you've done extensive research in this area with the Pearl Harbor and everything.
I have.
Yeah. How do you ever get down, and what's your opinion when, because there's also a great debate, and many have unfolded that a lot of this stuff was already known, you know, the, what do you know?
What was coming?
Yeah.
It's really based on fear.
Mm-hmm.
Truly. Everything that happened and the reasonings of why things have happened is truly based on fear. There was actually no physical evidence to show that that the accusations that that the military was throwing out there was actually true. And it's been proven by U.S. documents. So
what was proven? That
that we knew about it.
That we didn't know. That's proved. Okay.
Yeah, because they were also saying that there's Japanese submarines that are just outside of what was it, San Francisco or something. I mean, they weren't. But because, you know, this negative propaganda can be thrown out there and people will believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then that to them becomes their truth.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the truth won't come out till many years later, and if somebody unearths it and looks for the documentation. We every year the Japanese American community across the United States puts out programs called Day of Remembrance, and that's always around February 19th.
Yeah.
Because that's when Executive Order 9066 was created. And there's a young man named John Osaki with an S. He made this film called Alternative Facts, and he interviewed many people involved in the proceedings of what had led up to the incarceration of the Japanese Americans. And he had proven documentations that a lot of the allegations were completely false. And it was a really eye-opening film. You know, a lot of it, some of us, some people that are historians of this particular subject kind of knew it. But when you watch this film, you actually hear the testimonies of people that were actually involved in the documentations that were unearthed to prove it. It kind of just makes you think a little bit more, you know.
Yeah. Thank you. Brian, thank you for being with us here.
I appreciate your hospitality.
Thank you. And we started with that beautiful greeting of peace. We end with peace. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you so much.
And thank you guys for tuning in. And there's a beautiful quote by Nelson Mandela. It brought that, came up to my mind, where he said that people aren't born hating. They're taught this hate, and we got to teach them how to love. And when we live this beautiful way of life, if you're a Christian, if you love God with all your heart, mind, body, and soul, I mean, you don't want to harm others. You don't want to stand by when others are being harmed. Us as human beings, when we hear this kind of stuff, we don't want this stuff to repeat itself. That's why we study it here. And now you have this sentiment that's growing. We talked about how it came with the Irish, the Catholic, the Japanese. Now you have it with the Muslims. Get to know your Muslim. Visit a mosque, an open house. Call us, 1-800-662-ISLAM. Ask your questions. Don't let that fear of the unknown turn into hate, and then you attack what you hate. Get to know us, connect with us, and continue to watch The Dean Show. We'll see you next time. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.